all set? Okay, thank you, Your Honor, and Sussex County Council. As you know, I'm Vince Robertson. I'm the attorney for the Sussex County Planning and Zoning Commission. You do have my written submission. I'm not going to go through all of that. One thing I would like you to do, I know Mr. Forston went through the motion. That motion is included in its entirety as read, all 20 pages of it in the transcript. I would ask you to each of you, I don't expect there's going to be a decision this morning, maybe, but I doubt it. When you deliberate over this, just read that motion. I know that Mr. Forston plucked some statements out of that, but if you read the whole thing, I think you'll see all the thought deliberation that went into it. For example, one of the things he brought up was the third item. He said that somehow this decision was based upon public opposition to it. He quoted the fact, and this was in the third one, that there was a lot of testimony in opposition to the application. That's true, and that's in the motion. But the rest of the motion in that paragraph three states, while much of what was stated during the public hearing and in the written information is relevant, subdivisions are not popularity contests. They have to be decided based on the appropriate factors and the record before the commission. In this case, the record does not support the approval of this particular subdivision. So it recognized that there was a lot of public opposition, but it circled it back to the relevant factors. So the point being, take your time and read through that motion. I do have a PowerPoint presentation. I know that makes everybody roll their eyes. This is limited to things that mostly are in the submission, just to highlight those for illustration. So I hopefully won't bore you too much. This isn't thrilling information, but it's important information. The standard of review, as Mr. Moore stated, is section 99-39 of our subdivision code. That was reiterated in the Terrapin Island decision that you all acted on. And as Mr. Moore stated, has the commission misapplied the code? In this case, the answer to that's no. Does substantial evidence exist? The answer to that, as we'll see, is yes. Was the commission's decision based upon an orderly and logical review? I think when you look at that motion, all 20 pages of transcript of it, you'll answer that the answer to that is yes. And if all those are answered in those ways, the council cannot reweigh the commission's decision, and it must uphold the commission's decision. The other legal standard that Mr. Forston talked about and everybody acknowledges is Ashburn. Again, does the decision comply with the code, or does the application comply with the code? The answer to that, as we will see, is no. Can reasonable conditions be imposed? The answer to that's also no. As we stated in the written submission, there's no way that you could condition this into approval. I think I'm going to flip that around. For example, if the commission had said, we're going to approve this condition or contingent on eliminating the flooding, the problem with that is that's never going to happen in our lifetimes, if ever. And we'd probably be faced with the opposite appeal here this afternoon, that you conditioned this in such a way that it was a de facto denial. So again, under Ashburn, you cannot condition this application into an approval. The other Ashburn criteria is, was the decision an ad hoc one that imposed uncertainty on the owner? The answer to that is no. Stillwater knew that River Road flooded and admitted that it knew that DelDOT closed it. Their 2-year delay, now they talked about they went through PLUS and everything else which caused the timing delays with regard to this application. Actually, that 2 years was because they knew there was flooding. They had to figure out how to fix it. That's when they went out and acquired that additional piece of land that you saw Mr. Forston talk about on the screen. Stillwater, or this decision, was not a gotcha, as suggested by Stillwater. The inaccessibility to the property should have been known to Stillwater when they purchased it. Everyone who testified in opposition knew that that area flooded and flooded significantly. I just want to emphasize one of those because it sort of highlights all the opposition or all the testimony about the flooding was Judge Clark. He's lived in this location his whole life, I think, except for when he went to law school and college. And he testified that it flooded when he was a child, and it's still getting worse all the time. And that was Exhibit D to our written testimony. There was a lot of compelling testimony in the record about how the flooding impacted the schools. And I think this really drives home the point, and they're up there. And I'm just going to read them because I think they're important. These are three different people that said, during the school year, there's the occurrence of sunny day flooding and storms that the school children who are normally dropped off at another point have to be dropped off at the local fire station because the buses can't get through the flooding, and this certainly adds additional danger to the school children of that area. Another person testified, you do get a phone call in the middle of the day. You're at work, so you have to get to the fire hall to pick your kids up. If you're flooded in, you can't get to your kids to pick them off the school bus, and they're dropped off at the fire hall. So it is valid. And then the third one says, I can testify to the fact that buses can't get through. I have five children, and I get called at 5:30 in the morning telling me that I have to drop my kids off at the fire station. You're going to have a whole nother community in here, and they're going to have kids, and they're going to have to do the same thing. And the only way you're going to get through it is the emergency access, question mark. So in an emergency is a flood where they have to drive through salt waters, that's not okay. That was some testimony from the public talking about the flooding. One of the things that was significant, and it wasn't even a result of this application, was that DNRAC did a study in 2015 after outreach in 2013 and 2014 about this area of River Road. And that is Exhibit C. It's on the PowerPoint. I apologize with some of these. They're copies that have been scanned into the docket that then have been blown up on the screen, which make them hard to read. And I'm not going to read all of that, but I do want to highlight a couple of points that was in this DNRAC study from 2015 that talks about the flooding and it talks about the frequency of it. The Indian River Bay is coastally influenced and impacts several marsh areas within the community. The community is susceptible to frequent flooding due to coastal effects from the Indian River Bay and localized stormwater runoff. Changes in development and the natural environment have intensified flooding issues for the community. Residential properties and roads also flood frequently from local runoff because of stormwater drainage and transportation infrastructure that is undersized or in disrepair. The flooding can range from nuisance flooding of yards and residential roads to severe flooding of access roads, which affects homes and businesses. It also stated, and one part that's up there, drainage deficiencies include undersized or non-existent storm drain systems that require maintenance and low ground surface elevations. These deficiencies result in problems such as localized flooding, backwater flooding from inland marsh, or coastal inundation directly from the Indian River Bay. And then there's charts in there. They actually went all over Oak Orchard. These two that I showed are relevant to this portion of River Road. They talk about that it floods several times a year. The interesting thing is they said that the remedy is actually to raise River Road in this location from elevation 2 feet up to a finished elevation of level 3 and 4. In other words, raise it essentially 2 feet. Indian River Fire Company, as we talked about, also knew it was an issue out there. And they weren't just worried about emergency responders, as the applicants would have you believe. The Indian River Fire Company, and their first letter was March 3, 2022. Again, I want to highlight some significant comments in their letter because these are independent. This isn't Sussex County saying this. This isn't a resident just talking about that they don't want traffic or it's going to be bad. This is the fire company that probably has the most firsthand knowledge of what's going on out there. The fire company said it would be a grave disparity not to highlight and mention some of the drainage deficiencies that continue to plague the specific area during periods of inclement weather and tidal conditions. These deficiencies, for the most part, remain outstanding with no corrective action for any remedy in the designated area of this proposed subdivision. The proposed development lies between Chief Road and Leighton Davis Road, which has been identified as one of DNRAC's high priority projects. The proposed development entranceway on River Road clearly lies between two significant areas of roadway tidal flooding on River Road, which would preclude any successful passage during these tidal conditions. These areas of concern are being mentioned to highlight these tidal flooding conditions, which will impact safe passage of any prospective resident. I want to read that again. These flooding conditions will impact safe passage of any prospective resident from these areas until the tidal concerns subside unless an alternative access or entranceway is provided. So the fire company talked about the problems, and not just for EMS, they were talking about the residents themselves. I heard Mr. Forston talk about that this project's going to improve the flooding out there. I would direct your attention to the transcript. This wasn't actually cited in my brief because it wasn't really raised until their reply brief, but it's page 4, page 5, and page 7 of the April 27, 2023 hearing. And I have to admit, I don't know if that's in tab one or tab two, because the page numbering started over in each tab for that hearing. But this was from their engineer, Mr. Sauter, who talked about flooding. He said, and I quote, "Flooding is still going to occur on that road. Crest is still going to occur, but Stillwater Harbor shouldn't be impacting that." He says, so what are the, I'm sorry, and I don't know what he meant by I'm sorry. On page four, he talked about it's not going to make the flooding go away. Interestingly, I thought, because this ties in with what the fire company said, he said, I just volunteer this. I know, you know, having been through flood events, it seems to be that there's time when people, you know, if you have heart conditions or other, you know, ailments, that's when it's going to flare up. I know, you know, with my experience at least, that's the case. And then he sort of summed it up by said, we're never going to get rid of the flooding. And I guess his solution, which was kind of ironic, he said that the best solution was, so if I may say, if you have 100 houses built, 100 plus houses built, Oak Orchard is also going to pick up over 100 more voices that they can call out to DENREC and DELDOT to help them mitigate their flooding issue. So that was the solution. We're not going to fix it. We'll put more people in there so they'll complain, call DELDOT and DENREC, and improve the situation. I submit to you that's hardly a resolution of those flooding issues, which they admitted are not going to go away. So, as I said, Stillwater, and these are just some pictures that were with the fire company's written submission showing the flooding that they cited in that letter.
I want to clarify. Now, can you bring that picture back?
Sure.
So, on the left, it's showing the flooding, and I'm very familiar with that. But from my understanding, the entrance to the proposed development would be at the top of that hill, correct?
Well, the entrance to the development's between the two points of flooding. So I'm not sure looking at this
They can't access from further down the road because there's flooding on that end
as
well.
Yeah, that was right, and that's what DENREC pointed out. There was flooding at Chiefs Road and then the other way.
Both sides.
Yeah.
Right. I just want to be crystal clear on that.
Right. Yeah. No, that's a good point.
Your Honor, do you want me to wait on my questions, or I would it be a lot more conducive? I can wait. It is a little bit of a follow-up, but I can wait if it. You mentioned the fire company letter saying that the flooding was a concern unless secondary access can be acquired.
Yes.
And I heard Mr. Forsten say, I think, that they've met that.
I would respond to it this way. The fire company issued that letter that said they had concerns about residents and EMS. That's what hit the pause button on the development. And we say it's the developer. It actually wasn't even Stillwater. It was another company went out and bought that extra piece of property, which I'll get to in a moment. And then they went back to the fire company and basically said, here we have an easement. This solves the problem. The fire company never looked into whether they actually had the right to use the easement. They were just presented with this easement because that's what showed up on the site.
Well, I would assume you're going to get to that issue later, of whether or not they have the right to
use
that.
Yes, I am.
So I can wait on my further questions on. I just wanted to ask that question about the letter from the fire company.
Stillwater, they acknowledged that it had a problem. There was actually testimony from Mr. Erickson where they, you know, reviewed letters that were submitted. Generally speaking, we learn that the intersection of Chief Road and River Road floods approximately 4 to 8 times a year and is primarily driven by coastal flooding, again, not drainage running off of the property. The western crossing of floods approximately 2 to 5 times a year. That's those two points that we were talking about that bracket in this subdivision. They also studied information about DELDOT's monitoring of the bay elevation vicinity, which appears generally to confirm the flooding estimates that were provided. So they knew about it. The other thing was Commissioner Stevenson during the hearing asked, are you going to raise the road at some point? Where and how much of it? And Mr. Erickson replied, so we're not going to be raising the road. In the DENREC evaluation, one of the remediation methods that they mentioned was to raise the road in several locations where the road is very low and floods. But again, they said, we are not going to raise the road. So what they did is went off and attempted to acquire access to Jackson Drain Lane. This is the actual plot of Jackson Drain Lane. The 123 lots would be below this plot. This is significant, and this is what was presented to the commission. This map actually came from the applicant's submission. One of their other attorneys had done an analysis on it. But the green area shows the property that's owned by a different entity. It is Millsboro Holding Company, LLC. That's its own parcel. But it's significant is the people that had a right to use Jackson Drain Lane are only the ones that signed up there where that blue arrow is. You know, if you didn't sign and you didn't own a property that's on that signature line, you didn't have the right to use Jackson Drain Lane. And this actually was off that easement, and this is sort of a screenshot from that memo. Again, it's between these respective properties as shown on this plot prepared by McCann, Inc., and then a little bit lower down with the next arrow. Again, it's the common easement between the said properties owned by the undersigned owner. So it's those properties, those owners. Stillwater was not one of those properties and was not one of those owners. If you look at the tax map, that's the property that signed off on being able to use Jackson Drain Lane. And Jackson Drain Lane is to the top of that property. The 123 lots are to the bottom. That's not even owned by Stillwater. That's owned by Millsboro Holding Company, LLC, as you can see in the county's ownership records on the side. This is Stillwater. It's entirely separate. It was not one of those properties that signed off on that easement. Again, if you look at that tax map and you go back to this plot, that parcel of land doesn't show up anywhere on that easement plot. So again, Stillwater doesn't have the right to use Jackson Drain Lane. And if we had conditioned it upon the right to use Jackson Drain Lane, I submit to you that the county would have been subjecting itself from litigation from all those property owners who would have complained that you put a condition on this subdivision that we didn't consent to.
Your Honor, should I wait on my questions regarding Jackson Drain Lane?
Why don't we wait?
Okay.
And Stillwater, and I think we heard Mr. Forreston talking about this, they apparently concede this because they don't really touch on Jackson Drain Lane or try to argue that they actually have the right to use it. Instead, what they fall back on is the state code provision that says, well, fire companies and EMS can go everywhere. But that doesn't do anything for all those residents out there. That would be 123 residents, children, school kids, the elderly, like Mr. Sauter talked about, people that are having health emergencies. So, with that being unavailable, we're back to the issue of the undersized and underwater River Road. And Stillwater knows that River Road is closed during these events. So that's Exhibit F, that citation. It's not up here, but that was cited in our brief. So this leads to the code provision, 9917. It is undersized by county code. It does state in that blue highlighted portion that it has to be 50 feet wide. I would point out, Mr. Erickson actually confirmed that it's undersized. He stated, and this was cited numerous times in our written submission, so the right-of-way itself in that area actually varies, and it shows up as varying on the site plan too. The right-of-way itself in that area actually varies. It's like 42 to 46 feet wide, so it's an oddball one. Normally, they're pretty standard 50. So he's actually said normally the roads in Sussex County are 50. This one is variable, kind of weird dimensions. So they've admitted that it doesn't comply with 9917. The commission took all of this and other factors into consideration when it denied this application. So again, I want to turn to the motion briefly. If you haven't already, again, I'd like you to read that motion, all 20 pages of it. Again, that's Exhibit I to our written submission. In that, you'll find that there's actually 12 different findings. Of those, number 6, about flooding, itself has 8 sub-findings. And number 8, regarding the easement, has 6 sub-findings. That motion considered multiple topics as reasons for denial. One of those was non-conformity with the county's comprehensive plan, sort of under that heading. The first item talked about the importance of the inland bays, and it actually quoted language from our comprehensive plan. Number 10 of the motion talked about the county's hazard mitigation plan that's referenced in the conservation element. Another topic was all the issues with the road. That was item 4 and item 7 of the motion. I'm not going to go through all that, but I've been through some of it, but section 9917 again requires 50 feet. This one's anywhere from 42 to 46 feet. By their own testimony, it's oddly and weirdly shaped, and it's definitely low-lying with inadequate or non-existent drainage. We also, with regard to the roads, we had the fact that the developer stated that they're not going to fix or raise the road. That's right in the testimony. We had the fact that the private property owners in the vicinity who own land that would need to be acquired to raise or fix this road were not going to sell any of their land. I cited Ira Brittingham. He was pretty passionate during the public hearing in his testimony. He basically said, there's no way we're selling any land to anybody out there. The commission cited the inability to use the easement. That was item 8A through F. Again, there's no legal right to use the easement. The condition of the easement is poor, even if you were. The motion cited the impact of 1,200 cars on the one-lane dirt road. That's what they proposed. It was condition K that the homeowners association would allow the residents to be able to use the easement. They don't have the right to use the easement. Even if they did, the easement couldn't handle 1,258 cars, which is the daily trip that's generated by the subdivision. And of course, there was the opposition to the use of the easement by everybody who had access to it. That was all in the record, and that was all cited in the motion. The motion also talked about 99-9C, which is, I think you're all familiar with, that's 17 items, and I would say they're pretty specific in our subdivision code. Mr. Forson talked about the prohibition of Ashburn, and he mentioned that, you know, you can't deny a subdivision based on general principles, you know, health, safety, and welfare, and just sort of cite to that catchphrase, well, I don't think this promotes health, safety, and welfare. And I think the analogy being that 99-9C was something akin to that. 99-9C is very specific, and our motion cited to that specificity. For example, and again, this is number 5 and number 11 of our motion. The motion cited to the adverse effect on area roadways and transportation and the unsafe pedestrian and vehicular movement to and from the site. In support of that, we have the documented deficient road width, we have the documented flooding, we have the documented road closures, and we have the unsafe passage for EMS and residents documented by the fire company. One thing that occurred to me that wasn't even the motion, we didn't even talk about pedestrians. We're talking about fire and EMS and vehicles and all that sort of thing. People would be stuck too because they can't wander through the flooding. That motion also talked about the lack of integration of the project into the existing terrain and landscape, and that the project has not adequately addressed the preservation of natural features, and that the applicant has not addressed the minimization of tree vegetation and soil removal. And those weren't really general pie-in-the-sky sort of considerations. And I'm just citing a couple of things, they were supported in one case by DENREC in the plus comments that said, the project is located in one of the last remaining parcels of large contiguous forest in frequently flooded oak orchard area. Removal of these forest lands risks increased flooding drainage issues for residents existing and new, increased nutrient input to the inland bays, and significant habitat loss for migratory birds. That was cited in the motion. The next item that was cited in the motion that was part of the record was, we got the unusual attention of the Secretary of the Department of Agriculture. Secretary Skew stated, the Delaware Department of Agriculture opposes the Stillwater Harbor development currently under review. The loss of the riparian forest and wetlands will be substantial, potentially increasing flooding and inland bays pollution. It is a certainty that the removal of one of the most extensive tracts of forested land in that area will have devastating impacts on drainage for current and future residents. We do not believe this proposed development is considering the impact it will have on the physical landscape of the area, as well as the impact on local wildlife that will suffer a significant loss of its natural habitat. In addition to those two documented items, the commission's motion relied upon the record and the site plan that 78% of the existing forest is proposed to be removed. And again, that was a special concern at a documented environmentally important location such as this. One of the things that's important to keep in mind, there was sort of a one-dimensional map, and I'm going to jump ahead. I had this sort of in here in case. Stillwater, if you're familiar with that location, is not flat. It's somewhat higher, but there's a significant drop, and you can see at the bottom of this, that's the edge of Stillwater. And there's a substantial topographical drop from what's on the top down to the bottom where the wetlands are. And the commission was concerned about that. The commission had unanswered concerns about the grading that would occur at the top of that bank, the cul-de-sacs which came right up to that bank, and the roads besides the cul-de-sac at the top of that bank, along with the tree removal and the soil disturbance that goes along with all of that basically undermining the stability of the soils there and the impact that that would have on the wetlands below. Again, the commission felt that that item of 99.9C wasn't addressed. And the final one that I feel like really just hits home of all these, 99.9C, and I talked about it earlier, was the effect of the project on area schools. We had all that testimony about the existing problems with school children getting to school or home from school. I think the commission's concern was, why would we make that problem worse by adding 123 new families with new school children who also couldn't get to school on 4 to 8 times a year based on the flooding? It floods so much that the school, the testimony was, there's robocalls programmed from the school to these families that say, we can't get your kids at your house, or we can't get your kids to your house. You've got to drop them off at the fire company. That's how bad it is. I mean, there's flooding in Sussex County, but it's real flooding when you got a robocall from the Indian River School District saying, we can't get your kids to or home, to or from school. So I want to return back to the standard review on this. Again, that Terrapin Island decision. Does substantial evidence exist? Yeah, there's tons of evidence in the record on this to support a denial. Was the commission's deliberate decision based upon an orderly and logical review? They did consider this. They asked for additional information, and then they issued a 20-page transcript motion. It was a lengthy motion. It's probably one of the longest motions that the commission's ever issued, and that's because it's thorough and detailed. It was orderly and logical. I don't think there's any other answer to that than yes. Based on that, the council cannot reweigh the commission's decision, and it must uphold the commission's decision. I want to wrap that portion of the comment, and I cited it in the briefing, but think back to what Commissioner Holly Stevenson said, not during her motion, but during one of the conversations that or deliberations the commission was having. She said, I don't want it to be one of those cases where somebody looks back at us and goes, who let this happen? That was, I think, fundamental to the commission's deliberations. And it wasn't something that they just said, okay, that looks bad, we're going to deny it. They actually went back and looked at all that evidence of, you know, the flooding, the deficiency of the road, the DENREC sort of review of all the problems, but without any real solutions. And they said it's going to cost about $1 million back in 2015. Sorry about your luck, we're not doing anything with it to fix the road. The developer said they weren't going to fix the road. The record is full of reasons to support a denial of this application. So with that, I want to turn to the 45-day issue. So obviously, as the commission's attorney, we believe we're compliant with state law. You know, the state code does establish the trigger date, which must be the date that the record's closed. That's governed by Title IX. It's Title IX, Section 6810 and 6811 of the Delaware Code. But you also have to read that together with Title IX, Section 6961B, which says you also have to go through the technical advisory committee process. You also have to read that with 96962, which says you have to go through the DLDOT process. You also have to read that with the plus comment processes that are state code. If the application date was the date that the 45 days started, in other words, when they submit an application to Mr. Whitehouse, we'd never be in compliance. But that's not what the code says. There's all those different provisions. We wouldn't even be able to comply with FOIA, you know, in terms of getting public notices out 20 days in advance of a hearing. They sort of used a bunch of different dates and how to calculate this. One I thought was interesting, they said, well, it's the date of our last submittal. And they said our last submittal, the hearing was on April 27th, their last submittal was April 17th. That's when the hearing, or the 45 days, should start. I think that defies logic, because they could have submitted it back in March, which you'd be 45 days out before you even got to the hearing, you know? So that's just not logical. That's not the date of submission. The date of submission is when the closure of the record occurs. If it's not the date the record's closed, that would preclude a meaningful consideration of all the issues before planning zoning, just like you all. I mean, it would be asking you to act on something while the record's still open and you don't have all the information, which you all would never do. And probably somebody would claim it's a due process violation if you did. I mean, I guess, you know, if you're going to do that, essentially you'd be forcing the commission to ignore questions or unanswered issues that come up during the hearing. You know, it's important for everybody, the applicant, certainly the public, everybody, the commission, that we have all the information before a decision's made. I thought about this. If I'm in the applicant's shoes, I'm thinking, be careful what you wish for, because oftentimes a question comes up that may be harmful to an application that the record's held open to get an answer that actually helps an applicant. So if you're going to say, well, we can't hold the record open and get additional information because that jams us up under 45 days, there's times when that would jam an applicant too. And again, as we know, Stillwater took advantage of the record being held open by submitting a letter and video after the public hearing. The other thing is that's significant is the record was held open. Got out of order here. The record was held open on the 27th for three things. And it was very clear, everybody was there and everybody heard it. And candidly, the commission was kind of trying to determine how to put this into some semblance of order, so they asked me to do it and it turned into a motion. So the record was, one, held open for written comment from anyone until the close of business on May 5, 2023. That's one. Hold the record open for a report from county engineering with regard to the resource buffer shown on the preliminary site plan. That was two. And third, hold the record open for an analysis of the easement that was the subject of the application. That was number three. That was plainly stated. As you can see, it's clear as day up there. And Ms. Stevenson made that motion. Commissioner Wingate seconded it, and it was approved. So everybody knew that's what the record was being held open for. In fact, so did the applicants, as we know. They submitted a written submission on May 5, 2023. Noteworthy, they didn't object to any of these three reasons why the record was held open. They could live with it then. Then, on June 8th, it was clear that the record was closed. You can see on the bottom where that arrow is. Sure, thank you, all right then. This is after the easement discussion occurred. Because, let me back up on that easement. There was a lot of information that was submitted. There was deeds, there was that plot. The commission wanted independent verification on what was recorded, what that plot said. That's why the record was held open. That information was presented on June 8th. As Mr. Wheatley said, sure, thank you, all right then. So we will now officially close the record for Stillwater Harbor. That started the 45 days. That's when it started on June 8th. Even if we went back, I'm going to take a different position, because that's the date. There's no question about it. That's the date. But the record was, the information was received from Stillwater and others. That was announced on May 11th. That was the next commission date, was May 11th. If we use the May 11th date, we're still within the 45 days. But whatever, that's the date the record was closed. That's the official statement in the record. They closed it, and the commission acted 14 days after that. And you don't need to take my word for it. You all already decided this. This kind of makes this one a little easy. This was actually in the Coral Lakes appeal. And I'm going to read this because I think this tells you exactly what you need to say and what you need to decide on this 45-day issue. The commission cannot be charged with making its decision on a plan until such time as all steps in the process have been completed, including the public hearing, and the record has been closed. If construed as appellant alleges, this was the appellant in that case, the 45-day requirement would have commenced on January 18th, which was the date of an application. This interpretation would have required the commission to begin the review and deliberation process prior to the public hearing, which is a great source of information on a variety of issues from various sources that may affect the property subject to the plan, and during which the record is sometimes left open for receipt of additional information from agencies or staff. It would be antithetical to begin the review process before the commission is in possession of all relevant facts, supporting documents, and comments from various agencies, staff, and the like. So again, you all have already decided that 45 days starts when the record was closed. The record was closed on June 8th. The commission acted 14 days later. We're good with the 45 days. And to Mr. Forston's point, had the commission only held the record open for number one and number two, and then dilly-dallied waiting for something for me, that would have been a different scenario. But they specifically left it open for all three of those items, the public comment, the issue from county engineering, and the analysis of the easement. So everybody was on notice that's what the record was being held open for. That happened in a timely manner. The record was closed on June 8th, and we acted 14 days within that 45-day issue. So based on what you all decided in that prior action, we're good on time. So I used about 35 minutes. I wasn't sure how long it was going to go. I know this is, as I said at the outset, it's compelling information, not necessarily exciting information, but it's compelling and important. I would ask you again, go back and read that motion, that Exhibit I to our submission. It was extensive. It was an orderly and logical review, and the reasoning in there was sound. So with that, I'll entertain any questions you all might have.
I have a question. The issue regarding the River Road 50-foot right-of-way. What's your opinion on how the length of that right-of-way? Is it just, I think Mr. Forson said just at the entrance? And there were a couple, I saw 900 feet and I think 200 and some feet in one of the briefs.
So DelDOT talked about that if you're going to fix this, and that was also in DENREC as well, because it's not just the width, it's the elevation of it, because the whole thing floods. I think they were saying at a minimum it had to be 900 feet either way. We have Mr. Erickson's testimony saying that, well, we're not, regardless of that, we're not doing anything to fix the drainage out there on the road. My position is that it has to be 50 feet. That road does. I mean, that's what Mr. Erickson said. He said normally they're 50 feet. I mean, he admitted that normally roads are 50 feet. That's what we have to go on, that it's not 50 feet at the time of application. It's that road is not going to be 50 feet, final site plan or not.
Entire River Road.
Yeah. I mean, that's what the code says.
I had a question. I think you answered my question regarding, I assume you agree that comment we heard that Delaware law gives EMS emergency response and police ability to trespass over a road. And but you threw another in your brief, and also today you mentioned secondary access for residents, whether it be dropping kids off at school during a flood or going to the grocery store to get milk. You think it's required that the applicant provide secondary access for the residents?
I do, and here's the reason. And I want to go back to that 50-foot road question, also our 50-foot wide road question. That is a requirement of the code. I don't know whether. Let me back up. The subdivision code does give the ability for the commission to waive certain dimensional requirements. So if there was a subdivision that was undersized on a road, the commission could waive that requirement. They didn't in this case, and I think you have to look at it holistically, because it wasn't just a width issue. It was a documented flooding issue. I mean, it was, so we heard this in 2021. It had been documented officially probably before this, but DENREC spent getting URS to do a study on that back in 2015 after all kinds of public outreach. So everybody knew that there was a severe flooding issue out there. So either way, that road needed to be 50 feet wide and raised, and it was not going to be either. With regard to I'll call it the residence access, yes, that's an important aspect of that, that subdivision. That goes to the road width question. You need to have, and 99.9C, you have to have safe vehicular access and pedestrian access to and from a site. And that's not talking about EMS. EMS is a separate issue, and they can go anywhere. They could go across all of our properties, I guess, if they had to. It's interesting that Stillwater kind of backtracked off of that, because they said in their proposed condition, we're going to use Jackson Drain Lane for everybody. Okay, it's going to be EMS. It's going to be controlled by the HOA so that the residents can come in and out. And again, consider this. That roadway on River Road now had like 700 daily trips currently. This was 1,258 more trips that were going to be added to River Road based on the subdivision. That means when it floods 4 to 8 times a year, and it's not just an hour. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. When it floods, because it's tidal flooding, that's substantial, and that's lasting a while. That means that potentially 1,258 vehicle trips would have to be out on Jackson Drain Lane. And I'd submit to you that, that's not appropriate. And that's what the fire department's concerns were. They were concerned about EMS, but they also said that, the areas of concern are being mentioned to highlight these tidal flooding conditions, which will impact safe passage of any prospective residents out there. Stillwater kind of backed away from that when they realized, oh, our residents don't have access to Jackson Drain Lane, only EMS does. The problem is those residents are now stuck, you know, and I don't think the county, the Planning and Zoning Commission, should be put in a position of approving a subdivision when it knows people are going to be stuck during documented flooding issues.
Yes.
You were talking about emergency access for emergency vehicles, but, you know, implicit in the notion of an emergency is it's an unforeseen event. So it's something that requires, you know, special, you know, treatment because it's unforeseen. This is not an unforeseen event. This is something that we know happens multiple times every year. So I would think that the residents could come back and say, you don't have access to this easement because we had foreseen that this was going to happen. You're planning this. This is not an emergency by that thought. I just, you know, I don't know if
well, I think that's certainly true, you know, because based on what Denrec said, based on what the fire company said, based upon the known flooding, the documented flooding, I think those residents could come back because they put everybody on notice during that hearing. This flooding happens all the time. How do you declare that an emergency if it floods 4 to 8 times a year and currently we can't get in and out of there? You're not allowed to come on our easement because you knew or should have known that you don't have access. No, okay. I think that's the point. And that kind of goes back to what I started with under Ashburn. You know, it talks about you can impose conditions. Well, this is one of those, and I think it's a rare situation. Don't get me wrong. This is unique. But you can't, on this subdivision, under these circumstances, condition this into approval because you just can't make all that stuff go away.
I do want to make a few.
I mean, do you want to go straight into it, or did you want to? I mean, we're okay.
I'm happy to just work through my 9 minutes if folks are good to go.
We considered it. I think you had
I want to pick up on Councilman Riley's point real quick. The emergency is the fire. The emergency is the event they're going to. The point is, if there's flooding, the code says if you're responding to an emergency, in other words, if there's a need for EMS, if there's a need for fire, that's the emergency, not the flood. And so they have the right to do what they need to do in order to respond to an emergency, period.
So how do the kids get home from school?
Beg your pardon?
How do the kids get home from school?
Don't know, haven't thought about it.
I would think we'd want to know that.
Well, I'm not persuaded, you know, there's a lot of ways to address that question, and that's a conversation that should have been had rather than an outright rejection. And we're happy to have further conversations about that. But I get the concern, I get the issue. I want to read you, because you had asked the question, what our engineer said on stormwater management, because when you actually read his what his testimony was, I thought it was pretty good. He said, right now, he says, the net drainage towards Chief Road and River Road intersection will go from approximately 83 acres. In other words, there's 83 acres right now draining towards that location to approximately 54.25 acres. So the rest, because of swales and whatnot, are going to be handled on site going forward. So that's why you're getting the dramatic reduction in stormwater management to that area of flooding.
But does that take into account the fact that you've eliminated, it sounded like almost 80% of the trees on the property, which also take up substantial amounts of water? So they're not going to be there to do that, only the stormwater ponds.
The flooding occurs when there's tidal events and there's a big storm. So the stormwater management system is designed for that. That's when the flooding is occurring. The fact that there are less trees, which, by the way, they could clear cut this property tomorrow if they wanted, right? I mean, there's no prohibition on that.
That's true.
And there shouldn't be, because trees come back. But There's nothing wrong with, I mean, they're reducing the stormwater management. That's what the science, that's what the engineering tells us, and that's what we have to, we'll do a final design that the planning department will review and approve and confirm. I mean, it was so irresponsible, I thought, when Secretary Skuse and DENREC said, oh, you're cutting these trees, that'll increase the risk of flooding. DENREC, of anybody, should know about the impact of stormwater management regulations and the fact that you won't do that. And it was a very general letter written before they had really, all they had seen was the plan itself, you know, the early plus comment. And so the testimony is, and when you actually have to comply with the stormwater management regulations, you're not going to have that effect. And why the Department of Agriculture decided to weigh in months after, I mean, years after giving their plus comment where they did not object to the plan and say, well, this is agricultural land, we object to the loss of agricultural land. Every farm, I mean, every residential project in the area, if we put that map back up, used to be a farm, and there's going to be more farms that get developed. I love farms. I live in farm country, but I know it's not my property. And so we need space for housing and a growing population. The key, in my view, is high density. Sussex County, I think, is good on that because that means less farms need to be developed. But my point is that I just thought that these comments were unfair. And when we talk about flooding in the area, look, I get it. I have the same issues and concerns you do. But I've got a plan that complies. Riverdale Road, which, by the way, is on the opposite side of that intersection. What's the name of that project? Riverdale Community, thank you. That's 405 units there. And so, you know, when the Planning Commission in its letter of defense started off simply by saying, look at all the daily trips there they're going to be generating from 123 homes. Riverdale's 3.5 times the size. And so we're not allowed to proceed because we're generating traffic, but other projects in the area, including one right along River Road, which is much bigger, they're already there, so what, I guess they're just grandfathered. I mean, that's why you have a code with specific criteria that you have to comply with. And so I just wanted to
But respond. Would you agree that even with the 21% reduction in, let's stipulate that that's accurate, the road is still impassable?
I don't know if the road will be impassable or not. I'm not going to stipulate to that because 21% is a pretty big number when you.
But the flooding is coming from the bay and the river, not the.
Well, the flooding is coming from the bay, but it's because it's meeting stormwater flowing towards the bay. If I'm reducing the stormwater flowing towards the bay by 21%, you know, if it's 10 inches deep, does that mean it's 8 inches deep? I mean, is it passable at that point? I don't know. There needs to be probably a little more work done on that in that case. Also, to the extent DENREC did a study and said it was going to, you know, you have to raise the road, you know, 3.5 feet or 2 feet or 1 foot, I guess from 2 feet to 3 feet is what they said. Maybe now you don't have to raise it as high because this project is going to reduce the stormwater going in that direction. A reasonable condition might be for this project to have to contribute some amount of money towards the improvements when they get made. But simply saying to a property owner, sorry, there's flooding, not on your property, but there's flooding in the area, so you can't develop, that's not what the code says. That's not what the Delaware Supreme Court says. We can develop. We will make full disclosure to everybody. Nobody will be able to complain that they weren't on notice of what happens. But we're entitled to get preliminary plan approval. There's still a lot of questions that need to be resolved before we get final plan approval, and we talked about some of them during my presentation. But we're asking for preliminary plan approval right now. And that I think what was so dramatic about Vince's presentation right now, and he did what I thought he would do. He tugged at your heartstrings, right? He said, I've got a lot of concerns about this. And he tried to match them up with the language in 9C, 99-9C. But that doesn't provide any specific criteria. Elsewhere in the code, there's lots of criteria about flooding and what you have to do if there's flooding on your property and all sorts of stuff about that. And if you wanted, you could adopt an ordinance saying, property owners, you can never cut down a tree again. Fortunately, you haven't done that. I think it would be a mistake. But you could do that. And if you did that, we'd be bound by that. But you can't say, after going through all of this process, we don't think you're integrated enough into the landscape. I don't even know what that means. I certainly don't know how to comply with that. If you have some issues you want to address, say, could you make the slope a little more gentle? Could you do this? Could you do that? That's what reasonable conditions are about. Not just, we don't like the way you're doing this, so we're saying no. Because I could, you know, you've got an inch thick zoning code right now and a half inch thick, or 2 inch thick zoning code, a half inch thick subdivision code. I could do away with all that. I sometimes joke with people, you could make a code one page, and that page would say, bring us a plan and we'll tell you if we like it. That's what the Planning Commission is ultimately arguing here. We didn't like this plan. We didn't think it did enough about trees. It didn't integrate enough. Okay, you're allowed to think that. The question is, does it comply with your code? Because the whole reason you create a code is so property owners know what they have to do in order to get approval. We did those things. And the issue about the right-of-way, which Councilman Schaefer brought up again, it will be 50 feet wide at the entrance and along the front of our property. And that's in the record. And there's no requirement that a road be, you know, 50 feet wide its entire length. It says it has to take excess off a 50-foot wide right-of-way. It will be 50 feet. So that's not a reason to reject the plan. At most, you can make it a condition to say, make sure when you do the final plan, the right-of-way is 50 feet. But the planning department's not going to approve the plan if the right, if that dedication is not there. DLDOT's not going to issue its no objection letter and agree to this plan unless that dedication is there. So that problem gets solved easily. And that's when I said that the land use process is not a game of gotcha. You can't sit back knowing there's a technical defect or knowing that there's something not addressed that's easily correctable, and then when the record is closed, say, oh, sorry, you're out of time. It's just not what the process is about. On the 45 days, I wanted to just emphasize again what the code actually says. The code says, and this is the General Assembly talking to the Planning Commission, the commission shall approve or disapprove a plat within 45 days after the submission thereof. Otherwise, such plat shall be deemed to have been approved. Such period may be extended by mutual agreement between the commission and the applicant for the commission's approval. Now, when they closed the record, they said, okay, we're getting everybody till May 5th, and who wants to submit something? And we want to hear from our planning department about whether it confirms or not with the drainage and buffer ordinance that that was submitted within a day or two of April 27. And we want to hear from our attorney about this easement. We never agreed really to any of that, right? We weren't asked. We're at the hearing, but at that point, the public hearing was closed, and so I can't just get up in the middle of your Sussex County business meeting and start talking with you. We did go to other Planning Commission meetings after May 5th. That doesn't mean we agreed that the record was being extended indefinitely. And the problem that I have is the General Assembly said 45 days. It didn't say to the Planning Commission, 45 days when you think you've got all the information you need. If you don't think you have all the information you need, what does it say? That period may be extended by mutual agreement between the commission and the applicant. The whole point is so it, you know, can't take 3 months, it can't take 6 months. Suppose the record hadn't been closed on June 8th after, or they hadn't said the record was closed on June 8th, and maybe they didn't meet and vote on this till August or September. Suppose the attorney needed until August or September to weigh in on this. Talk to the applicant, get their agreement. That's what the code says. Otherwise, it's supposed to be a short process. And if you don't like 45 days, get the General Assembly to make it longer.
Can I clarify that? Because you're saying 45 days from the date of submission.
Right.
So the, when the applicant submits the application, we have 40, but we historically run 6 months or better, don't we?
Absolutely.
I mean, at one time, I think during the boom, we were running better than a year.
We'd never be in compliance.
Well, right, but the answer to that is that you get the agreement of the applicant. When you guys were, you know, just when that, when this place was just humming with plans coming in all the time, people knew that it was going to take 6 months. And you scheduled the hearing as part of submitting your plan. I mean, it's no accident that this plan was heard on April 27th, but only submitted on April 17th, right? I mean, everybody knew what was coming, and it had been worked out. And there's nothing inappropriate at all about saying, hey, you know, we know you're going to submit your plan. You went through your pre-preliminary plan submission stuff with the department, and then you work out the schedule going forward. That can all be done. It just didn't happen here. We submitted our plan, and once we submitted our plan and the hearing, the public hearing was only 10 days later, I mean, we're entitled to approval. That's what the code says. Now, we still have to get final plan approval, as I've said many times, and there's a lot that we're going to have to do. And some of the reasons for denial of the preliminary plan are things that get addressed at final plan. So they'll either work out or they won't, and we'll either get the plan approved or we won't, a final plan. But that's not a reason to deny preliminary plan because you think maybe you can't get final plan. I know I'm out of time. Oh, thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that.
Mr. Robinson wouldn't object.
Judge, if I ask questions, does that eat into Mr. Forston's time? Before I lose track of what I want to ask regarding this issue, can I ask it now?
Yes, sir.
So if suppose that we say the clock started, the 45-day clock started on June 8th. You submit that 45 days expired and should have, and the plan should have been approved if the date was June 8th?
Well, they took their vote on June 22nd and denied. So, I mean, that's less than 45 days after June 8th.
So that would mean 45 days did not expire.
Correct. That's what it would mean if you assumed that the clock started on June 8th. But I don't assume that, because if the clock started on June 8th, it could have just as easily started in July or August or September.
I think Mr. Robertson said in his opinion, the clock started on June 8th, I think, is what he said.
He did say that, and I disagree, because it's 45 days after submission unless you get the applicant's agreement. We didn't agree to an open-ended period forever. We did agree to May 5th, at least implicitly, by submitting something on May 5th. So you could consider that the final submission by the applicant.
And I hear your answer. Thank you.
Anything else? And to the extent we've gone past 45 minutes, given the nature of the question.
Never trust former judges, but anyway, it's fundamentally fair that both you and Mr. Robinson be allowed some additional time. Have you covered what you needed to say?
You know, I took all sorts of notes about specific things that Mr. Robinson said, but I, you know, in the interest of time and not wanting to beat a dead horse, they would all be repetitive of my main point, which is when you go through that motion, and he invited you to read it, and I think you should read it. We attached it to our papers too. What you'll be struck by is no specific criteria that they tie those concerns to. And that's what the Delaware Supreme Court has said. That's the only reason the Delaware Supreme Court has said you can reject a plan. I really wish that if the Planning Commission had concerns about issues, they had engaged in a dialogue with the applicant. And despite Mr. Robertson's statement that, oh, well, reasonable conditions doesn't apply here because there are no reasonable conditions that will work, that's the law. And I'm sure we could have found some conditions that would have at least made the Planning Commission feel better and made Councilman Riley, who I think is feeling uncomfortable, and others feel better.
I'm just trying to tease out information.
No, I understand. I appreciate that. So that's kind of my concluding statement. We're here today asking that preliminary plan, the decision either be reversed or be deemed approved. We still have to go to final plan, and there's still a lot of work to be done. And I think a lot of the concerns that were raised get addressed in that final plan process.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
There being no other questions by members of the council, then I would declare the hearing closed and return it back to the president.
Sure. So the hearing is closed. Hearing is closed. Public comment obviously is done. Entertain motion now to go into executive session for pending potential litigation.
So moved.
Motion, Mr. Hudson, second.
Second.
Mr. Riley, any questions on the motion? We'll take the vote. Mr. Schaefer?
Yes.
Mrs. Green?
Yes.
Mr. Hudson?
Yes.
Mr. Riley?
Yes.
I will yes. Now, executive session now.